I remember once I went into a restaurant and I asked for some toast, a cup of coffee, an egg, and a few kind words. And the waiter brought me back toast, coffee, the egg, and the check. I said, haven't you got a few kind words? She said, don't eat the egg.
If I, one Sunday, wore my mitre on the side of my head like that. I know a bishop who wears his that way because he's bald and fuzzy. Well, that's funny, see?
Fulton J. Sheen, a man for all seasons. A man who knew the power of prayer. Each day, in his daily holy hour, he sought the Christ light for his journey. Each day was different, like the seasons. In summer, God warms the earth and paints a tapestry of colors to give our journey, where we are going, more joy. From the Bible, we remember other journeys by two men, Peter and Paul. They walked on these ancient gray stones called the Appian Way, the road to Rome. Quo vadis, Peter? Quo vadis, Paul? Whither goest thou?
Believe me, fellow Americans, I tell you that before the flood, in the book of Genesis we read, and in the days of Noah, there was violence on the earth. All of the violence that happens in our country is a fever graph. Read it. And it points to a decay in our civilization. How are we going to get out of this? The eagle always builds its nest high in the mountain crevices when the young are hatched. The eagle pushes its young over the nest. And they fly down to what to eaglet eyes must seem like sudden death. And just before the young eagle crashes, the mother eagle swoops down from its nest, down to the abyss and catches the young, and flies up into the sky, swoops from out it again, and repeats the process until the bird has learned to fly. Moses saw that, and he wrote, as the eagle stirs among the young, so does God stir among the nations. Maybe God is stirring us, bringing us to the brink of danger, in order that we might begin to examine ourselves and restore Jefferson, the dignity of man, and a belief in God. Our nation is too full of those that are crying down. Down with the universities. Down with schools. Down with the churches. Down with teachers. Down with government. Down with the police. Can you build anything down? You cannot. Certainly time in our nation to change our words. Let's begin now to use the word up. Up from all of this filth. Up from this violence. Up from this indifference of courts. Up! Up to the hid battlements of eternity. Up! Up to God.
His words have proved to be as timeless as a gentle ocean wave, seeking the shore where you walk in the season of autumn. Your companions are the seabirds, and a friendly sea creature that comes to say hello. The blue colors turn to autumn gold. You watch the boats out in the sparkling blue, wishing for a voyage to a new world or a secret place like a modern-day Columbus.
I remember during the council, I was waiting one day for the bus that took us to the council, and I saw a street cleaner in front of the hotel where I was staying, and I went up to him and I said, how long will you work today? He said, 12 hours. What time did you get up? He said, 4 o'clock this morning. And I said, what is your duty? He says, nothing but just sweeping the gutters.
About a mile of gutters here in Rome. How much do you earn? He told me it was really a trivial wage. I said, tell me your philosophy of life. And he said, you're going to the council, aren't you?
Yes.
You're going to make important decisions for the church and the world.
Yes.
He said that if I clean my gutters with a greater dedication than you do that work, the Lord is far more pleased with me. That's right. He saw that we have work in the world, and it can be a dedicated and divine and holy work. Now, this is the good side. There's a kind of a bad side to this, too. I'm going to mention it for just a few minutes, and then I'm going to get back again to the good side. This concern with the world is called secularism. Its bad side is that some would like to do away with the divine and the sacred. We've had a series of thinkers in our day that believe that in order to uphold the world, one has to destroy the divine. That's one of the reasons, incidentally, for the God is Dead movement. These poor thinkers believe that in order to make room for the world, you've got to get rid of God. Bultmann says in order to make room for the Christian message, you have to get rid of the historical Christ, practically. And we have the author of Secular City. He practically identifies the secular city and the kingdom of God. And even in the field of religion itself, today the holy are on the defensive. This world spirit has gotten hold of us to such an extent that many do not like the holy. I may tell you that it's gotten so bad that when any of you people see us priests on our knees, you ask us if we lost our contact lenses. Well, that's enough of that.
In the season of spring, we celebrate Mother's Day, the day of flowers, of love, and faith. We remember the words of Mary at the Annunciation, when the angel Gabriel told her she was with child. I am the servant of the Lord, be it done unto me according to thy word. In the book of Psalms we read that children are a gift from God, but in the book of life we know that mothers are the real gift. They are the poetry and love of our lives, and love can be a many splendid thing.
And he wrote, I fear to love thee sweet, because love's the ambassador of loss. Love's the ambassador of loss. White flake of childhood, clinging so to my soiled raiment, thy shy snow at tenderest touch will shrink and go. Love me not, delightful child, my heart by man's snares beguiled, is grown timorous and wild. It would fear thee not at all, wert thou not so harmless, small. Because thy arrows not yet dire are still unbarbed with destined fire. I fear thee more than hadst thou stood full panoplied in womanhood. All the while, he's being haunted by something. And I told you of that poem of haunting. I gave it to you one year, The Hound of Heaven.
he wrote.
He went back again to dope. The Maynells still cared for him. This hound was pursuing him. But despite this shell, the shell that first came to the Maynells, he had no stockings on and his toes were out through his shoes and dirty old brown coat, no shirt. Consumptive, because of the nights he slept under the cartwheels of London. He still had this love. Love. Love that pulled him. Probably that was pulling him at the beginning of his life, and so he wrote, "O world invisible, we view thee. O world intangible, we touch thee. O world unknowable, we love thee. Turn but a stone and start a wing. 'Tis ye. 'Tis your estranged faces that miss the many splendored things." Love's the many splendored things. Not earth love. Heaven love. That Thompson saw everywhere. And haunted by that love, he went finally to his reward, and one day, well, in London, I went out to Kensal Green Cemetery. And I asked someone whom I had met in the cemetery, "Do you know where the tomb or the grave of Francis Thompson is?" "No, I never heard of him." So I walked and walked, and I finally came to a slab that read, "Francis Thompson, 1859-1907. And then there came a line. An unforgettable line that drew one back to all of his loves of childhood. And that last line on the tombstone was, "Look for me in the nurseries of heaven. Love's a many splendor thing."
It is a beauteous evening, calm and free. The holy time is quiet as a nun, breathless in adoration. The broad sun is sinking down in its tranquility. The gentleness of heaven broods o'er the sea. We live in the light of our imagination. We begin as children, racing with the wind. As the years pass, we build many memories within the portrait of our world. It is a journey well traveled, for to experience faith, hope, and love is to have lived, to have used our time well. On this pilgrimage, back to a place we never left. Bishop Sheen's message, The Ages of Man.
Did you hear the announcement of the subject tonight? It's on the Ages of Man. Now, there are various ways of treating this subject. One of the light ways, of course, is there are three ages. There's youth, there's middle age, and my, you do look wonderful. I was going to call this telecast at first The Seven Ages of Man on account of Shakespeare. You remember his review of the seven ages in his drama, As You Like It. The scene was laid in Arden, a forest, not a paradise by any means. And the Duke, one of the characters, gives us the seven ages. And we will go over these seven ages of Shakespeare and then see if we can find another way of treating them. We certainly couldn't take the seven ages in a program of this length, because if we gave 3 minutes to each age, well, we would be skipping over them very quickly. Now, here is Shakespeare. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. His acts being seven ages. First, the infant, mewling and puking in his nurse's arms. Then the whining schoolboy, shining morning face and satchel, creeping like snail, unwillingly to school. Then the lover, breathing like a furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow. And then the soldier, full of strange oaths, bearded like a pard, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation, even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly, with good capon lined, with eyes severe, beard a formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances, and so he plays his part. The sixth scene shifts to the lean and slippered pantaloons, with spectacles on nose, pouch on side, his youthful hose a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice turning once again to childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange, eventful history. In second childishness and mere oblivion, sans eyes, sans teeth, sans taste, sans everything. Friends, did I ever tell you this story apropos of tonight's subject? The little girl was told by her mother about all of the family problems. Jimmy had the mumps, and Susie has the measles, and Grandma had broken her leg, and she was told to pray, and she said, "Dear God, please take care of yourself, because if anything happens to you, we'll all be in the soup." But the subject is somewhat related to that. It's On God Is Dead. I heard of one man who was an atheist for a year, and then he gave it up because there were no holidays. We'll try to explain to you this much-discussed subject, God is Dead. Now, there are two ways in which this can be understood. God is dead. It can be understood one way. I don't know how I happened to write that. My angel, leave it there, angel. The name God is dead. That is one sense in which it is used. In other words, the name God has no significance today. The other meaning of the phrase, God is dead, is that the reality of God is dead. In other words, God himself is dead. Here it's only the name. Now, this is one of the very popular ideas today. Why is the name of
God, meaningless. I will give you their argument without going into the names of the philosophers. I'll not mention any of the popular American ones because, listen, their theory won't be known in 10 years from now. This telecast would outlast their theory.
People of all faiths recognize Bishop Sheen as one of the greatest communicators of the 20th century.
As I look back, I know very well that I have never received the punishment that I deserved. God has been easy with me. He has not laid on me burdens that were ever equal to my failures. And if we look into our own soul, I think that we will also come to that conclusion. For God speaks to us in various ways. As C.S. Lewis put it, God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks to us in our conscience. And he shouts to us in our pain. Pain is God's megaphone. Pain is heaven's loudspeaker.
And like the ripples that are made in a brook or sea when you throw in a stone, the ripples of pain, instead of going out to distant shores, they narrow and narrow and come to a central point where there is less of the outside of the circle and more of the center. Not the ego, but the real person and the real self. And one begins to find oneself alone with God. That is what happens in pain. The one on the right saw that. And as we look at pain and those in suffering, we only wish that they could understand the mystery of it. Why does it happen? See, I'm sure that that man on the left said, well, God is evil. That's why he said, if you're the Son of God, save us. All God does anyway is cure. No. When I was a boy and had a toothache, I would always go to my grandmother because she'd give me oil of cloves. And I was afraid to go to my father because he'd take me to the dentist and he would hurt me. One day he took me to the dentist and the dentist said, you have a very grave infection in your tooth and is spreading through your organism. And that tooth has to be pulled. And it's going to give you some pain. The dentist pulled the tooth. My father stood there, holding my hand, which really did no good at all. And then, even though I was just a boy, I somehow reasoned that why doesn't he stop the dentist? Why does he allow him to make me suffer? And because he wanted to prevent that infection through my body. And so the Heavenly Father says to his son on the cross, "You take on the sins, the infections, and all the poisons of the world." And the Father was with him. The Father let him suffer because of the eventual good that it would do for us in the resurrection.